This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Andrew Seidel about his new book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American.
It's not only un-American, it's on the march. We got a big problem with these people. They would like to turn our country into a theocracy, which is exactly what the Founding Fathers did not want to do. Give a listen.
Attorney Zach Wolf joins us from Washington, D.C., amidst the hotbed of Supreme Court decisions.
Yeah, and the new ones coming up with two reactionary judges just put on the bench could be bad news for all of us. Let's see what Zach Wolf has to say.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The men who wrote the United States Constitution and the first 10 amendments to it, known as the Bill of Rights, were mostly not Christians. America was not created as a Christian country. That's a myth. Nor was it founded on Judeo-Christian principles. That's another myth. The Founding Fathers were deists. They were products of the Enlightenment. They did not believe in a God that played any role in human affairs. They understood from European history the terrible consequences of not separating church and state. Today's Christian nationalists, evangelicals who are in truth white nationalists, are relentless in their attempts to tear down the wall of separation between church and state guaranteed by the First Amendment. They want a theocracy where their fundamental religion rules us. These people have substantial political power. They are much of Trump's base. We speak today with attorney Andrew Seidel, a constitutional litigator with the Freedom from Religion Foundation and the author of the just published book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. Andrew Seidel, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me on. It really is a pleasure.
Congratulations on your book. And we want to start by asking you about the founding myth that your book refutes is that America was founded as a Christian nation. Why is this a myth?
Well, it's a myth. It's a pernicious myth. And it's, in my opinion, it's done to deliberately influence public policy now. But the argument that you hear is that we were founded as a Christian nation, we're based on Judeo-Christian principles, and the important part of the argument is that, and we've strayed from that foundation, we've got to get back to our godly roots. That's what the Christian nationalists are arguing. So the question that I really pose in the book is something a little bit deeper just than the idea that we're a Christian nation. You know, did Judeo-Christian principles positively influence the founding of the United States of America? And I think the answer to that question is no, they didn't. We were not founded on Judeo-Christian principles, and it's a good thing, because those principles are fundamentally opposed to the principles on which the United States was built. There's this, the two systems differ and conflict to such a degree that, to put it bluntly, Christian nationalism is un-American. And that's what I really try to show throughout the book, is that there is this fundamental disagreement and disconnect and opposition between the two systems. And that's one of the, that's really why I think it's a myth. You know, a lot of people will talk about, for instance, the Treaty of Tripoli, which says that the United States isn't in any sense founded as a Christian nation, which is a great line. But it goes much deeper than any of the quotes that people trade on social media to this irreconcilable difference between the two systems, between Judeo-Christian principles and the principles on which America was built.
Now, the founders of this nation were products of the Enlightenment, and most of them were deists. Did biblical principles influence the founding of the nation? Our government?
Not at all.
Oh, okay.
They didn't come close. And I mean, there's a number of different ways you can make this point. You could look at, for instance, the records of the Constitutional Convention. Which was, it was, you know, secret at the time they were drafting the Constitution. The founders met for, you know, a number of weeks in Philadelphia, and almost never referenced the Bible, and certainly never referenced it for anything, any of the important policy debates that they were having. They didn't point to it and say, look, the Bible tells us to have three different branches of government, because the Bible doesn't say anything about government other than you should have theocratic monarchies. So they were really not influenced in the slightest in terms of crafting our Constitution by biblical principles. And that is one of the central arguments that I try to make in the book.
You write that the great and unique achievement of the founders was to create a secular state. And it's really a profound notion, a secular state. It never happened before. Why was this their great achievement?
Because, I mean, you just mentioned it, you know, it never had been done before. This was something that had never been tried. You know, we just talked about how the founders were influenced in the Enlightenment, and the idea for keeping state and church separate was certainly floating around in the ether of the Enlightenment. But no nation had put that into practice until the American experiment, until the Constitution was drafted. So America's unique contribution to political science is the separation of state and church. We invented it. That idea is really one of the only unique things that we put into practice. It's one of our country's unique contributions to humanity. Really, everything else that is in our Constitution. And there's a great quote by Gary Wills from his book, Under God, Religion and American Politics, where he makes the same point. Really, everything else in our Constitution had been done at some point before, in both theory and practice, but not the separation of state and church. Until America, no other government in the history of humanity had sought to protect citizens' right to think freely by divorcing religion and government. And we really ought to be proud of that contribution to the world. But Christian nationalists are doing their best to destroy it, and that is what I am fighting against.
For those who've just tuned in, we're speaking with Andrew Seidel. He's the litigating attorney at the Freedom From Religion Foundation in Madison, Wisconsin. He's just written a very good book called The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. Andrew, America had been an English colony. The founders were very familiar with English history. There had been a lot of blood shed in England over religion and the role that it plays in government. Talk about that, please.
Well, not just England, all of Europe, too. I mean, James Madison spoke of the, quote, torrents of blood that were spilled in the old world trying to achieve uniformity in religious belief. And when the founders looked at this history, it became very clear to them that there was only one way to avoid that, and that was to keep state and church separate. And, you know, they didn't just do this because they were looking to do something new. They were trying to protect the ability of citizens to think freely, to guarantee their freedom of religion. Because there is no such thing as the freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion. A secular government, one that does not have the power to influence, coerce, or even recommend to its citizens which religion they should adhere to or which God they should pray to, that is a prerequisite for genuine religious liberty. And the founders were the first people to understand that and be willing to take a chance on that experiment.
Andrew, prior to the American Revolution, which separated American colonies from England, the Puritans had set up a theocracy in New England. I have a compound question. What was the nature of their government? Why did the founders find it repugnant? And what did this theocracy outlaw?
Christmas, for one. I mean, the original war on Christmas was waged by the Puritans and the Pilgrims. No public celebrations of Christmas. So when you ever hear the war on Christmas, this mythical war on Christmas, that's who you ought to be thinking about. But really, they established these little monochromatic theocracies in what was then the wilderness of Massachusetts. And it's really important to note, you know, we have there's this other myth that floats around in all of American mythology. We all learn it in school, and you hear it constantly, and it's that our forefathers came here seeking religious liberty. And usually when people say something like that, they're talking about the Puritans and pilgrims. But that's not true. It's half true. They fled religious persecution, but they didn't come seeking religious liberty. When they fled England, they didn't come right to the New World, to them the New World. They actually went to the Netherlands, to Leiden, which at the time was the most liberal country in certainly in their area, certainly in Europe. And they had religious liberty there. We would call it tolerance today, probably not true religious liberty. But people could worship as they saw fit, and certainly they could. But people were leaving the church. They were losing members because people all of a sudden had the freedom to worship as they wanted. And the church fathers got together and said, look, we're not going to have any worshipers left if we keep this up. We got to get out of here. We need to go somewhere where we can establish a church that unites the secular government power with our religious power. We got to go somewhere where we can establish a theocracy. And that's why they fled here. And that's what they did. And it was this oppressive government that really few people wanted to live in. So they fled persecution and then engaged in persecution themselves. And I've got a whole chapter on this. And if we are looking for a colony that better reflects the American spirit and the American ethos and our founding principles, we really ought to be looking to the colony at New Amsterdam. And there's some great stories that I tell in the book and show, compare and contrast the colonies, the Pilgrims and Puritans with the colony at New Amsterdam. And it really is striking how much the New Amsterdam colony, how much better it reflects our American values today.
Well, what kind of things did the Puritans in Massachusetts outlaw? If you were living up there, what couldn't you do? Really, some of them on pain of death.
Yeah, I mean, it really was, if you imagine legislating straight from the Bible or their version of the Bible, their interpretation of the Bible, I mean, that is what it is. They outlawed, again, public shows of Christmas cheer. They outlawed other forms of worship. I mean, you know, they did execute a number of people. The colony of Rhode Island was established because people were fleeing all the oppressive theocratic religious laws that they were imposing on people. It was, you had to go to church. You had to go to church at these times. There were different penalties for that. It was uniting religious law with government power. And that's, unfortunately, the goal of many Christian nationalists today. And when the Founding Fathers looked back, when they were drafting our Constitution, they said, that's not what we want to do. And we often forget, too, we should just talk about this for a second, how expansive the colonial timeline was. You know, we tend to think of it as it was old, so it must have been close together. But, the Puritans and the Pilgrims were planning their colonies 150 years before the Founding Fathers were getting together and drafting the Constitution. Now, Jamestown was settled 180 years before the Constitutional Convention. I mean, there are people listening to this show for sure who were born closer in time to the founding of this nation than Jamestown was. So it's really this expansive timeline that we often don't think about, which I think helps to understand why it may not be as influential as Christian nationalists claim today.
Andrew, what laws would Christian nationalists establish if they took power? And what would an American Christian theocracy look like?
Well, it would not look American. I mean, that's the number one thing. And I mean, a Christian theocracy in this country, and I should say that they have seized power and they're on their way to doing this. There's a case before the Supreme Court right now which is arguing that Christian parents have a right to send their kids to Christian private school with taxpayer money. So that's certainly one thing that you would see. Instead of seeing rules in place, constitutional rules in place, that would prevent every citizen from being taxed, and then the government turning around and giving that money to a religion that, for instance, tells them they're going to go to hell and be tortured for all eternity if they exercise their freedom of religion, you would see the government doling out taxpayer funds to churches. And there has been, unfortunately, a trend, both in the Supreme Court and in the legislatures, going that direction. And it's, if you want a good example of how it would start, you need look no further than the Project Blitz playbook. Project Blitz, for people who don't know, is an explicitly Christian nationalist push. And they put together a playbook for state legislators to start passing these laws. And the goal is to redefine what it is to be an American. So that to be an American is to be a Christian, and to be a Christian is to be an American. With things like getting In God We Trust on all of our public buildings, and forcing kids to say we are one nation under God in school. Things that are already, unfortunately, familiar to many people. And then they start to ratchet it up. And eventually the goal is to make Christians a privileged class, to make the law reflect that. And Project Blitz, I mean, the handbook is out there, and I talk about it in The Founding Myth. You know, that is the handbook for turning the United States into a theocracy. And it's happening right now.
The Founding Myth, number one, was that America was founded as a Christian nation. But there's a second myth, Andrew. I wanted to ask you about that. And that second myth is that America was founded on Judeo-Christian values and not Enlightenment values. Please compare Judeo-Christian principles to the principles upon which the U.S. was really founded.
Well, the point that I really try to hammer in the Founding Myth, and this is the thing that I think makes the book new, that people who haven't, who maybe have read something about the Christian nation argument, or maybe even feel comfortable making that argument that we're not a Christian nation, will get out of the Founding Myth, because there hasn't been a book like this yet. It's different. Previous books have offered these gentle corrections to the Christian nationalists. They say, you know, here's what history tells us. Here's what the founders actually meant. Here's what the founders actually said. And they've kind of left it at that. But correction and facts aren't enough. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a President Trump. You know, pointing out errors is insufficient. So this book does that, but then it takes the next step. Because patriotism has no religion. So this book is actually an assault on the Christian nationalist identity. Not only are Christian nationalists wrong, their beliefs and identity run counter to the ideals on which this nation was founded. They are un-American. And that's the point that I'm trying to make when I bring in this comparison between Judeo-Christian ideals or principles and America's founding principles. There is just this fundamental disconnect and disagreement and opposition between the two systems. And it runs the gambit from things like the biblical idea of obedience and hell and crime and punishment in the Bible, the idea of redemption, the idea of original sin. All of those are thoroughly un-American or opposed to American principles. And then it's even bigger. You know, one of the most common claims that we hear is that America was founded on the Ten Commandments. But if you break it down and actually look at that, which I do in The Founding Myth, it becomes very clear that that is absolutely not the case. And then, in fact, the Ten Commandments, all of them, yes, all of them, even the ones people are saying, well, what about that one right now? Yeah, all of them conflict with American law.
Andrew, my parents brought me up intentionally with no religion. So I'm curious, do you think religion is necessary for an ordered society? And did the founders believe that? And what do you believe?
Oh, that's such a great question. I first of all, good on your parents. I am an atheist. You know, I don't think children should be pushed one way or another. They should be able to decide on their own. That's what my mom did for me. And I declare that, you know, some people would call it a bias. I actually think it's a strength in when we're making this examination early on in the book. Now, the founders did believe that religion was necessary for a society to succeed. And we now know that they are absolutely wrong about that. And there's a whole chapter in the book devoted to this. I mean, what almost every single measure of societal health or well-being, the least religious countries score better on than the most religious countries score worse on. And the same trend holds true in the United States itself. So the most religious states, Mississippi, Alabama, et cetera, score worse. They have higher rates of teen pregnancy, higher rates of STDs, higher rates of alcoholism, obesity, all of that. They score worse, higher rates of murder, higher rates of violent crime across all those measures than the least religious states. And again, this holds true internationally. So we know from science that it is not true that religion is necessary for a country or a nation or a government to survive and thrive. The founders did believe that, and they were wrong, and I go to great pains to explain why they were wrong. But it also, to me, that's a really key point in the book, because it shows, too, that the founders didn't think religion was necessary for everyone. They thought it was necessary for the masses. They thought it was necessary for the people who didn't have time and education to think about moral questions and to research moral questions in their personal libraries, or who didn't have these discussions when they went to college. In other words, they thought it was necessary for people other than them, which also means that they didn't use those religious rules when they were crafting our nation because it wasn't necessary for them, which is backed up by all the records that we have.
Andrew, Erwin Chemerinsky, who's a favorite of Heidi's and mine, had this to say about your book, and I want to share this with the audience. Seidel looks at the history before the ratification of the Constitution and refutes the view that the United States was meant to be a Judeo-Christian country. He also demolishes the myth that American law is based on Scripture. In this beautifully written book, Seidel powerfully shows that Christian nationalists are arguing for a vision that is at odds with the essential nature of the Constitution and American government. That's Erwin Chemerinsky, who is the dean of the University of California Law School in Berkeley. And I agree. I thought that your writing is really beautiful. And my favorite passage is at the top of page 173. And Heidi and I wondered whether you might read that for our audience, please. The first two paragraphs on 173.
Beginning, it would be difficult?
Yes.
Is that what you... Okay. It would be difficult to write a law that conflicts more with America's founding document, the Constitution, than this rule. I am the Lord your God, you shall have no other gods before me. First, our Constitution protects every citizen's freedom to worship as they choose, chiefly by requiring and guaranteeing a secular government. Second, the people, not God, are supreme. The Constitution's first words are more poetic and quite obviously more reflective of American principles. We, the people. The First Amendment is one of humanity's greatest political and legal triumphs. Every fiber of that legal commandment stands opposed to the Judeo-Christian God's Ten Commandments. The First Amendment was originally proposed as several different amendments that were consolidated. The six rights enshrined in the First Amendment, secular government, religious freedom, free speech, free press, free assembly, and the right to petition the government, can be summed up as the freedom of thought. It reads, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or of the right of the people to peaceably assemble and to petition their government for a redress of grievances.
Seidel, to that I say amen.
Yes.
Amen.
The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American, by Andrew Seidel. Talk about the organization for which you work. What is the Freedom From Religion Foundation?
The Freedom From Religion Foundation is a national nonprofit. We are a membership organization. We've got more than 30,000 members, and we have two purposes. We work to educate and to separate. So we work to educate the public about what it is to be a non-believer in the United States, and we work to keep state and church separate. We've got 10 full-time attorneys on staff. I am just one of that really amazing team of attorneys. And then we've got more than 30 staff working to really take this organization to the next level and fight back against Christian nationalism. Right now we are in just a desperate fight against Christian nationalism. It is a threat to our republic. It's an existential threat to our republic. I believe that. That's why I wrote The Founding Myth. And the Freedom From Religion Foundation has been on the front lines for more than four decades now. Our legal team handles typically between 4,000 and 5,000 state church complaints every single year. So this is what we are doing. We are fighting against Christian nationalism and against theocrats on the ground and in the courts if necessary.
Tell us about some of your most significant cases and the cases that you're handling now.
Well, I mean, you know, the significance is an interesting word there. You know, I worked on a case not too long ago where a family came to us, and a kindergarten teacher and a first grade teacher were forcing their children to pray before they went down to lunch every day. We wrote a letter to the school district. We always try to resolve these issues with education first. You know, I don't actually want to sue a school district and take money out of the school district to distract them from the goal of educating our children. But if they're going to violate people's rights, we will. So anyway, we try to resolve it with a letter. I wrote the principal and said, hey, you got to stop this. And he said, no, the teacher has a religious freedom right to force other people's children to pray. So we ended up having to sue there, and the teacher was fired, and the principal was reprimanded, and family went away happy. But you know, a lot of those cases, we don't actually have to take to a lawsuit. You know, we get somewhere between 200 and 400 victories that we are told about just off of letters that we write. So you know, you're talking one or two a day. We're solving these issues for people around the country, and those are absolutely significant to the people and very rewarding. But then we're also taking impact litigation in the courts. You know, so for instance, we just won a big case in the Ninth Circuit against a school board that was essentially at their school board meetings, they had turned it into a church service. They were reading from the Bible, they were proselytizing, telling people they needed to convert to Jesus, preaching. We won that case both at the district court level and then at the Ninth Circuit, and then the Supreme Court refused to hear it. You know, and then it ended up costing the school district more than $250,000 for fighting this case. We've also been really active at the Supreme Court over the past few years. I think in the last 12 months, something like that, we've done more than 10 briefs to the Supreme Court, including in a case that was they heard the oral argument on just yesterday. So, you know, it really runs the gambit for us from just handling these individual complaints all the way up to taking cases for those individuals to impact litigation to litigation at the Supreme Court. We're doing it all.
Andrew, we just have a few minutes remaining, but I'd like to touch on the issue that you just mentioned of Christian nationalists hijacking our nation and the work that you're doing in the courts. Are there things that listeners can do to supplement your fine work in the courtrooms?
I mean, absolutely. I mean, we need everybody who's listening to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation if this speaks to you. And I'm not saying that just because, you know, we'd like to have your membership dues. Obviously, we would. But we really need people to join their voices with ours. You know, when I write to a school district or when I go into a congressional office and I say I represent 30 people in your district or 300 people or 3,000 or 30,000, having those numbers makes our arguments much more influential. So we need people to join their voices with our voice. So I would really encourage everybody to join. And if you know FFRF isn't your cup of tea, join the ACLU. Support the organizations that are out there pushing back against this. And the second thing is that people really, you have to fight. James Madison said that outspoken resistance is the first duty of citizens. And Christian nationalists have persuaded too many Americans to abandon our heritage, to spurn our secular foundations in favor of their myth. But it is time to reclaim our heritage. Remember, America invented the separation of state and church. It's an American original. It's time to reclaim that heritage and to bury their lies. So people really need to understand the arguments that are in this book, because as progress marches on and as we reach the point where Christianity's power and privilege are reduced to equality, the Christian nation myths are going to be trumpeted with renewed vigor. You have to be prepared to refute them factually and vocally. So the founding myth gives you the facts and then it gives you better arguments, but really you are responsible for the rest. It's the first duty of citizens.
Oh, we can't echo that enough, Andrew. Thank you so much. And congratulations, really, on your magnificent book, The Founding Myth, Why Christian Nationalism is Un-American. What is your website?
FFRF.org, if you want to join up. I'm all over social media, Andrew L. Seidel. And Heidi and Michael, thank you so much for having me on. It really was a pleasure.
That's S-E-I-D-E-L, Andrew L. Seidel. Andrew, you're doing terrific work. You didn't have to recruit me. I've been a member for quite a while. Keep up the fight, and you take it easy.
Thank you. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org. for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. The Supreme Court is poised to hear several highly charged disputes as the justices return to the bench in 2020. It promises to be one of the most politically volatile terms in recent memory. Since October, when the term opened, the court has heard high-profile disputes over LGBT rights in the workplace, the scope of the Second Amendment, and the deportation status of nearly 700,000 young undocumented immigrants. The remaining cases on the court's docket are equally explosive. The justices will confront novel separation of powers questions, including whether to release to investigators the financial records of Donald Trump. The court will be asked to draw new lines between church and state. And for the first time since Trump's two nominees joined the court, the justices will hear a case on abortion. Joining us to talk about some of the hot-button arguments awaiting the court in 2020 is attorney Zachary Wolf. Zach teaches writing at George Washington University in Washington, D.C., before which he worked at the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Zach is the editor of Farnsworth on Contracts and the author of Hate Crimes Law. Zach, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, there's so much to talk about. Let's start with Trump's financial records. As listeners probably know, Trump is the first president in decades not to make his financial returns public. Can you state the nature of this case? Is it a separation of powers?
Right. So there are actually three separate cases. One involves a subpoena from the Manhattan District Attorney, and it's involved a grand jury investigation, so we don't officially know what is underlying it, but it appears to be related to hush money that was paid to silent Stormy Daniels during the 2016 campaign. And it's possible that some of those hush money payments led to false business and tax filings, which would be a violation of state law. So Trump has intervened and sued to block the subpoenas to his accounting firm, and he's claiming that the president is immune from criminal investigations while he's in office. He lost in both the district court and the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit in particular relied heavily on United States v. Nixon. Basically, if Nixon could be ordered to turn over tapes from White House conversations, then certainly Trump Organization accountants have to produce tax records they have.
And what's the second case?
The second case involves subpoenas from two different congressional offices. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform issued a subpoena to the same accounting firm, and then the other subpoenas were from Financial Services and Intelligence Committees, and they serve the Deutsche Bank and Capital One, which are one of the lenders for Trump. Again, Trump intervened trying to stop those entities from complying with the subpoenas, and they've lost at every stage so far. Trump is basically claiming that the records are not being sought for a valid legislation legislative purpose, which is what Congress needs in order to issue subpoenas.
Let's just talk about the big picture, Zach. What is at stake with this? I know there was a third case, but it's probably similar. What will the ruling determine? Is it presidential immunity, essentially?
That's right. I mean, the cases that that previously invoked concerns around presidential immunity involved Nixon and Clinton, and certainly this week in the Senate trial involving Trump, a lot of it is a concern is with disruption of the presidency, that the president can't be involved in congressional or prosecutorial processes while he's trying to act as president. And really, Trump is trying to explode those concerns and apply them in a completely new context. Remember that these are old, existing documents that are in possession of other entities, private companies, and Trump isn't actually being asked to do anything in response to these subpoenas. So especially the grand jury case involves an extreme claim of presidential immunity, but it's even more than that. Trump is trying to say that he has the power to block prosecutors and legislators from asking for things from others, from even private companies, if the president disapproves of what he thinks they're searching for that information for.
Now, what impact, if any, do you think the decision will have on Election Day?
It's so hard to know. I don't know if anything has an impact on Election Day anymore. Just because of how incredibly polarized we are. I think on that front, it's notable that both U.S. v. Nixon and Clinton v. Jones were unanimous. It's hard to imagine having something without a dissent from the court, let alone having an impact on the entrenchment in the electorate now.
Well, what I'm worried about, Zach, is that the Supreme Court, with the addition of Gorsuch and Kavanaugh, they're authoritarian in their ideology, and they may say that Trump is the leader and you can't get information on him. He's got a right to keep it secret. I'm afraid of an adverse decision. Are you?
I am afraid of that, and the big open question is how much do these justices care about conservative values, right? This has been argued and decided before. There's precedent. We say that the president is not above the law, that there are established limits on how much he can be imposed upon, but it's not absolute. And will these justices actually hold to the values that we have articulated when this has come up in the past, or will they decide that we're now going to just give Trump a blank check?
Yeah, really, there's a difference between old-line conservative values and the creature that we have now and what he stands for. But let's turn to the Louisiana abortion law. This is the first abortion case since Trump's two court nominees took the bench. What are the facts in the Louisiana case, and what are the issues?
So the Louisiana law requires that doctors have admitting privileges at a hospital within 30 miles of where the abortion is being performed. The case will actually be heard on March 4th. This is June Medical Services versus Gee that we're talking about.
Didn't we get a favorable ruling on that issue in the past?
Yeah, not that long ago. In 2016, the Supreme Court decided Whole Woman's Health versus Hellerstedt. In Texas, the law had been allowed to go into effect, and the court found that it was likely that about half of the Texas abortion clinics were forced to close as a result. They also found that the requirement does not have any real health benefit. Complications involving abortion are very rare, and when they do occur, it happens in the days following the procedure after the woman has already left the clinic. So the requirement in Texas wouldn't have brought any health benefits. That led the court to decide that it was an undue burden, that there was a severe burden of half the clinic closed, and then on top of that, there was no or balance against that, there was nothing to serve a legitimate legislative purpose. So in this case, Louisiana is arguing that at least half of that equation won't be an issue. They're saying that, they're pointing out that Louisiana only has three abortion clinics, four abortion doctors total in the state, and one of those doctors already has admitting privileges. So the state says that those doctors will be able to get privileges at the hospital within 30 miles, and therefore there won't be the burden of a clinic shutting down as a result.
Zach, another hotly contested issue the court is going to take up is religious school scholarships. The case is Espinoza v. Montana Department of Revenue, and it has broad implications for church and state relations. What's that case about, and what's the issue?
Right. So the court heard arguments in that case just this last Wednesday. Montana has a 100% tax credit for donations and scholarships for students to attend private schools. There obviously was a concern with support for religion by the state through this mechanism. So initially, Montana's state tax office issued a rule saying that these scholarships could not be used at religious schools. This then caused a concern that religion was being discriminated against, so the Montana Supreme Court responded by just striking down the entire program. So no taxpayer support of private schools at either religious or non-religious schools.
Zach, the Bridgegate scandal is back in front of us. Listeners may recall Governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, most likely knew about or instigated a scheme where they would shut down traffic going across the George Washington Bridge. Listeners who aren't from New York may not be familiar, but there are three ways to get to Manhattan from New Jersey. You can go through the Lincoln Tunnel, or you can go through the Holland Tunnel, or you can go across the George Washington Bridge. So the bridge was pretty much closed down to traffic. It took 2-3 hours to get from New Jersey to New York. A lady died in an ambulance as a consequence of it. It was a huge scandal. Now the governor's allies are being accused of colluding to close the traffic on the bridge, and the issue is before the court. Can you discuss what's going on and the consequences of a decision?
Yeah, so this is a particularly brazen and bold-faced kind of defense that convicted official is putting forward. They're basically asking the court to rule that fraud laws don't apply to petty corruption. It's pretty clear that the officials engaged in what traditionally would be defined as constituting fraud. They lied, made up a story in order to get Port Authority to do something that would benefit them, and that cost Port Authority money. They had to obviously pay to shut down and then reopen lanes, and then they also had tried to come up with a cover story about how this was needed for a traffic study, which nobody actually wanted, but money was spent to put on this sort of phony traffic study. So public funds were expended based on a fraudulent scheme that benefited someone. That's pretty textbook fraud. But they're saying that, nevertheless, the fraud statute should not be read to include these kinds of cases because it's basically a government ethic violation, and that this risks turning all government ethics laws into felonies.
Zach, the court is also going to decide, and this is a big one, if the decision to terminate DACA is unlawful. If they rule that it was unlawful, what can we expect? Is it going to bring us back to September 4th, 2017, which was the day before the government announced it was terminating DACA, when renewals, new first-time applications, and advanced parole were all available?
So it's deferred action for childhood arrivals. It was a policy that was put into place under Obama that basically said they would not prioritize deportation of individuals who arrived in the United States in undocumented status, but as children, absent some other reason to deport the individual, committing a serious crime and things of that nature. It's fairly straightforward prosecutorial policy decision-making and prioritization that we have a lot of laws out on the books. So we don't have the resources to enforce all of them, so the executive branch gets to decide what kinds of cases it's going to bring and what kinds of cases it's not going to bring. The Trump administration was quite adamant rhetorically that this was unconstitutional. And so the only reason that they gave on the official administrative record was that DACA was unconstitutional, that Obama had exceeded his constitutional authority, and that was the reason that they were rescinding the program. That is not true. It's quite clearly constitutional. Every court that has addressed this issue has said DACA is constitutional. And so as a result, then, the only reason that the Trump administration has given is an invalid reason. The crazy wrinkle here is that if Trump administration had come forward and said, we're rescinding it because we want to please our constituency and our people who vote for us don't like immigrants, they probably could have done that. They probably could have just said, this is a political decision that we're entitled to make. But there's strong doctrine in administrative law that when the government does something, it has to have a legitimate reason for it. And if the only reason that is given is one that is false, then that's not a legitimate reason. So it's quite possible that the court will take this on. It really has interesting similarities with the census question, the citizenship question on the census that was decided last year, where, again, probably they could have added it if they had given their true reason for adding the citizenship question. But Chief Justice Roberts was the fifth vote saying, you don't get to lie about the reason. They concocted the story about how it was going to help them enforce the Voting Rights Act, and that was quite clearly a false reason that they gave. And so even Roberts said, you do, on the administrative record, we're not letting you do this because you haven't given a valid reason. So we'll, obviously, this is the big question. Will Roberts be a fifth vote on a case like this as well, where, again, it's pretty clear that the reason that they've given is not the true reason?
Zach, we have a few minutes left. Let's turn to whether a part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 prohibits employment discrimination for LGBT persons. I believe the issue is whether the part of the law known as Title VII, which bans discrimination based on sex, also applies to sexual orientation and gender identity. Tell us about the case they're considering.
Sure. So there are, again, three cases. Two of them involve someone who was fired for sexual orientation, and the third involves someone who was fired for transgender identity. It's a really interesting case involving what the words actually mean. So Title VII of the Civil Rights Act says that you cannot be discriminated against on the basis of sex. Doesn't say anything about sexual orientation or transgender identity. The argument from the employees is that sex was the operative difference, that if they had had a different sex, they would not have been treated this way. In other words, if a female employee was discovered by the employer to be dating a woman, she was discriminated against, terminated for that basis. If it had been a male employee who was dating a woman, the employer would not have a problem with her. Therefore, the only difference is the sex of the employee. That seems to be holding some sway in the courts and even with the justices. I went to the oral arguments, and some of the conservative justices seemed to be troubled with the strength of that argument. That is really a very, very straightforward but-for causation. If it had been an employee of a different sex, they would have been treated differently. Therefore, sex is the discriminatory intent. Again, the big question is, will the conservative justices see the basic truth, basic logical truth there, or will they cling to some sort of ideological point to say, well, but we don't want to reach sexual orientation or gender identity under Title VII?
Zach, before we have to let you go, you're there in Washington, D.C., and it's a hot time in that town as we speak because the impeachment is going on. What are your thoughts about the impeachment situation? I don't imagine you think that Trump is going to be convicted by the Senate. But what do you think of the whole process in the Senate? The fact that so far no witnesses or documents have been allowed. Is this really a trial?
It sure doesn't seem like a trial. The idea that you would have just the opening arguments from the House. When the House was deciding whether or not they would impeach, there was quite frequent comparators to a grand jury indictment. And I think that's a fair indictment, that you only need suspicion, you only need enough evidence to indicate a sufficient level of suspicion. And so the idea that the only thing that we rely upon at the trial is what came in front of the grand jury proceeding makes no sense. This is not part of our legal tradition. And on a broader level, it just has to do with do we believe that anybody cares about the facts anymore, right? Or do we believe that anybody cares about the, not anybody, but certain members of Congress, do they care about what actually happened and assessing it in the traditional way that we would assess a president who asked for foreign involvement in the election?
You know, what's disturbing to me is that this is yet another benchmark in the Trump administration's disassembling the rule of law. 2 weeks ago, we had the assassination of a foreign leader on a peace mission in a foreign country. And now we have the Republicans, this insurgent organization, really cutting the heart out of the whole impeachment process that was set up by the founding fathers to have some control over the executive. And now the executive is just ignoring the process, gutting it, holding their nose at it. What's your take on the disassembling of the rule of law?
I think that's right. It's just picking away at the normal rules of, or what we thought were the normal rules of conduct and expectation. You know, a moment ago, we were talking about Bridgegate. Obviously, at the highest level of what's happening with Trump and the White House is what is most dramatic and important to worry about. But there's a sort of petty corruption that we also need to be concerned with. This follows from a 2016 decision involving the former Virginia governor, McDonnell, that basically the Supreme Court opened the door for pay for access. McDonnell was taking money and then setting up meetings for somebody who wanted public universities to help him with a nutritional supplement that he wanted to market. Pretty clear bribery for many people. But the Supreme Court said that setting up meetings for donors is just routine politics and is not bribery. So on the micro level version of this, but this concept of things that seem beyond the pale and are now being turned into, well, that's just the way we do things in the United States now.
Zach Wolf, how can people read your writings and follow what you're doing online?
I do a blog at prophecywolf.com, so that you can see all of my Supreme Court recommendations.
Say that again, please. I want to write that down.
Sorry, it's prophecywolf, prophecwolfe.com.
Well, Zach, you're certainly in the hotbed of Supreme Court activity right now. We really appreciate your clarity on some of these issues, and we hope to have you back on in a month or two.
Thank you. I really enjoyed talking with you this morning.
Thanks so much, Zach. You take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Wilson. Wilson.
Yeah.